I am Norbert Aust, and you're listening to the European Skeptic Podcast, the real ESP experience.
You're listening to the ESP, the European Skeptics Podcast, an independent weekly show set up to bring you news, interesting topics and interviews with people mostly from Europe, building bridges and breaking down language barriers to show the world how active and awesome the skeptical movement is in the region. This is episode 403. I'm your host, Andreas Pinter, and joining me for the show are my co-hosts, Annika Harrison and Pontus Böckmann. Sziasztok!
Hallo!
Hey son. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to this show that has never gotten any technical issue whatsoever.
No, except, never.
except for last week. We did actually publish our episode 402 very early on Friday morning, as per usual. But for some reason, it wasn't pushed out to the world. It was only visible on Spotify because they have a separate setup, and you could listen to it directly on SoundCloud, but not many people do that. So we had a big problem. We couldn't fix it. And we have been very unhappy with SoundCloud, which is the service we've been using for all these years, for a long time. So in the end, we just cut the cord or whatever you call it, and we migrated the whole show over to something called Acast, which is a different service, much more modern, and that took a long time. So a lot of people didn't actually hear the episode until Sunday, but it should be okay now. It should not require anything from our listeners. They shouldn't have to do anything. I'm still a bit skeptical about that, because that's what the show is all about, being skeptical. But it seems like people are now downloading through Acast instead of SoundCloud and without knowing it. So it seems to be automatically fixed. I don't know.
Did you say automagically?
Automagically, yes. It's a good word. Okay. Yes.
It's a modern wizard.
I just wanted to double check.
Yeah. Going forward, the only people that will have a problem with this or have a change with this is the people who have in the past been listening directly on SoundCloud. That will not work anymore. But I don't think that's more than a handful of people. And I'm not sure why I'm telling you guys this, because if you do, you can't hear this. So it will be business as usual from now on. And
preaching the choir here, huh?
hopefully more reliable. But I should also end this by saying this is a reminder that we cannot run this show without some expenses. There's always a technical aspect that we need to pay for. So if you want to help us, please consider doing so. You can go to patreon.com/theESP and sponsor us with $1 or $2 or whatever your currency is per episode, and that will help. That will go a long way to help us fix these kinds of things.
Or even per month, if you're like, oh, I can't afford to do that for every episode, you can also put a limit in that you only want to do this and that amount per month. So yeah, we're happy for anything.
Also, as an insurance that we don't suddenly trigger 10 downloads in one day and you'll get robbed of all your money, you can limit it. So you say $1 per episode, but no more than 3 episodes per month. That kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that when it comes to buying equipment and stuff that are some of the expenses, but I think it would probably be a good idea for me to get something like an anti-echo wall, because speaking of technical issues, our listeners might be hearing a little bit of echo coming with my voice, and I'm sorry about that, but I could not find another place to record. But the hotel room I'm in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And this is, I already showed you guys the pictures. Yeah, this is a ridiculously huge. Large room. And
is it the presidential suite?
Yeah, one would think so then, because of the tour. I'm the tour guide. I get the mm-hmm. good treatment, right? No, it's not the case. But instead, this is the size of rooms that this hotel operates with. So yeah. It's just ridiculous. So I'm sorry about that. I don't know how much of it can be fixed in post. I'll try my best to provide Pontus with usable and workable recording. We just have to soldier on with it, I'm afraid.
And I've got good news, because usually we do the WTF talk in German that I always talk about here that I do with Bernd Harder, Holm Himmler and Lydia Benecke and other guests. Usually we do it every 2 weeks, and now we have an extraordinary satanic panic update next Monday. Ooh. So that's one out of turn, so to say. So yeah, I'd be happy to hear from people that will watch it and just wanted to give that a little shout out.
Mm-hmm. So that's on Monday, but it's in German though.
It's in German, yes. It's next Monday the 13th.
All right. Before we get into the meat of the show, I have a little update on last week's Word of the Week. I noticed already when I was editing, actually, but it was too late to fix it. So I decided we could just issue a correction this week. And Olaf, who sent us the Word of the Week, he also came back and clarified. So the phrase that we talked about last week was, and I will actually play the file again because I cannot pronounce it. It was this phrase.
Hou de koeien uit de sloot halen.
Hou de koeien uit de sloot halen. Something like that.
Yay!
And yeah, and I translated that as drag the cow out of the ditch. And it was a little bit of a confusion whether the cow was alive or dead. But Annika actually suggested on the show that the first word, Ude or Ute, means old. And I didn't confirm that because I was ignorant.
You don't
but
speak
it does
Dutch,
But it does indeed mean old, of course. Sorry for that. And in addition to this, Olaf has this to say in his new email, quote, "We use the expression in quite particular circumstances when revisiting almost forgotten, often unpleasant events, such as quarrels from the past," end quote. So that's just to clarify that Ude means old, and it was an old cow, and it was very, very dead, and was, of course, just a figure of speech. But please continue to send in new suggestions for Word of the Week to info@theesp.eu. There should be some sort of skeptical or scientific angle to it, and something that most people haven't heard about, but also maybe they have heard about it, maybe they misunderstand it, it's very often misunderstood. So great fun. So keep on sending those in. Thank you.
Yeah, these are awesome. They're always really interesting. And it's also a good effort, I would say. I think the skeptical movement really lives from people putting in work, being active, doing the good effort, even if it's just sending us an email. But also, of course, on the bigger scheme, for example, grassroots things like Guerrilla Skepticism on Wikipedia, or looking at studies and writing letters to the editor, like people like Edzard Ernst or Norbert Aus do, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm, yes. So we had the pleasure of interviewing Norbert Aus about his experiences about doing just that, reading up on scientific paper or so-called scientific papers, and then sending an email criticizing the paper if it's pseudoscience. And for example, it could be about homeopathy. And before we listen to the interview, I just want to point out one thing. It had to happen once in 8 years of doing this. I forgot to switch on my good microphone. So in the first or most of this interview, you will hear it through the crappy microphone that I'm using for the Zoom call. But it's not me talking too much, so I hope it's still okay. And I think we should play that interview now.
Mm-hmm. Every now and then, we interview someone whose work is of interest to our listeners and skeptics around Europe. Norbert Aus studied mechanical engineering in Darmstadt and worked in research and development of pumps and turbo machinery. Norbert is the initiator and thus one of the founding members of Informationsnetzwerk Homöopathie or Information Network Homöopathy, also short INH or in German INH. He is now spending his well-earned retirement researching the non-effectiveness of homöopathy with the ENH and claims around that. Norbert, welcome back to the ESP.
Hi.
Ah, good to see you again. It's been a while.
Yes, a couple of years back.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Yeah, and it's great to see you again. So yeah, what's new in information network homeopathy? What's happening there?
Well, it's been some time that we have been together on this line. So to wrap up all what we did is would be very, very demanding on the listeners' time. So in fact, we do a lot of things in politicians to write open letters to argue about homeopathy and other so-called alternative medicine. And we did a lot of things, but the most impressing, that's for me, but for my specialty, is looking up studies and research papers on homeopathy and trying to find what's wrong with them. And sometimes, on occasion, we are quite successful in doing so, but unfortunately science is not always following our leads and sometimes it takes some time until they do what has to be done.
Politicians as well are hard.
Politicians is very poor reaction here in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I understand the Ministry of Health has a lot of problems on his hands, and some or most of them more demanding than our, let's say, minor problem with so-called alternative medicine. But still, it's problems, and we would like to go further. Of course, we were very successful that the medical chambers of Germany mm-hmm. almost all retracted homeopathy from their the additional education that you have to undertake when you are a doctor in working on your patients. Mm-hmm. And so they skipped homeopathy. This was a good thing. We never dreamed to achieve that in our past, but and we were not alone, I suppose. But mm-hmm. the success has many fathers, and so here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Good. That's progress anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Any progress is good progress, at least in the regards of homeopathy and its support in Germany. And you said before that you are looking at studies, researching and checking if that did good science. And I heard that you wrote a letter to the editor about a certain study, and there was an interesting development happening with that. So what happened there?
Okay, so we have two letters to the editor aiming at retraction of the papers in question. Mm-hmm. And this one you are referring to is the latter one. This was a systematic review mm-hmm. of a certain Katharina Gärtner, who looked into homeopathy in the treatment of ADHD, or attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. Mm-hmm. And she came to the conclusion that homeopathy would achieve something. I have this paper here. I can quote it. Individualized homeopathy showed a clinically relevant and statistically robust effect in the treatment of ADHD.
So robust improvement.
Robust. The problem was there were five or six studies included, and we had a look at them, and we found a couple of issues. One study was completely reversed in the citing. The original author found something that placebo was advantageous to homeopathy, and Gärtner cited it the other way around. And there were other glitches. And we had them out to the journal in question, which was Pediatrics Research. It belongs to something like the Nature Springer conglomerate mm-hmm. Altogether there. And we, that is Udo Endrescheid, myself, and we had Edzard Ernst as support. He checked the language, of course, and mm-hmm. Some of his experience flew into it. But the analysis was pretty much mine. Mm-hmm. The study was published in June of 2022, and beginning of July 2022, we had this letter out to the editors. Yes, we were pretty
fast. That's pretty fast, yes.
Yeah, pretty fast. And I almost forgot about it due to the other issue that we are having, and I will come to that later, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So about a year after this, we filed our letter to the editor, we received a letter from the editor, and he informed us that our paper was not valid for publication. I write to you in regards to manuscript number this and that, entitled Flawed Meta-Analysis about Homeopathy in the Treatment of Children with ADHD, which you submitted to pediatric research. Regrettably, the priority given to your paper was not sufficient for acceptance for publication in pediatric research. So you point out to the editor of a well-respected journal. They mm-hmm. have an impact factor of something like 5, and they are listed in Medline and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you point out that the study they received is definitely wrong, this is not sufficient priority to get this letter published.
Yeah.
So we responded to the editor, and of course, we didn't expect much to happen again. But later in September, we received the information that the study was retracted, finally.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool.
Good.
Yes, and you find the an account of it in Retraction Watch. I guess, Annika, you have the...
Yeah.
We will link to that in the show notes.
We will put the link in the show notes, yes.
Very good.
And we were happy with that, but still... There is some bad taste onto that. You know, there is a well-renowned journal with high impact factor, respectable all over, and there is utter bullshit published to them.
Yeah.
And nobody, not the editors, not the scientific community, nor the peer reviewers, nobody reacted to that. It took some skeptics, me an engineer, Udo is a legal man with the legislature, mm-hmm. and Edzard is an old retired and no longer really active in science. He's doing a lot of things and a lot of stuff, but he is not really anymore a member of the scientific community. It took the three of us to get this bullshit out of the scientific database.
Yeah. And even then, their first reaction was not to do anything.
Yeah.
Yes. Hopefully that our second letter made them do something. But finally, it was completed. And the retraction notice pretty much follows our letter to the editor that we filed in June last year. Mm-hmm. So nobody else has filed any letters or raised any new concerns about this paper.
People are probably not skeptical enough.
No, but
well, they should.
Yeah,
they should.
But they should be. But isn't it so that people who pay attention to homeopathic papers, paper promoting homeopathy, are just homeopaths, and they have no reason to question it? They say, "Oh, good, it's now more data to support our point of view." And other doctors or researchers who do not pay attention to homeopathy, they don't read it even.
Yes, that is exactly the problem. And so homeopathy, papers on homeopathy somehow are below the radar beam. Nobody really gives a damn for them because everybody knows homeopathy is bullshit.
Mm.
Why bother to write a letter to the editor? Why bother to read it even? It's bullshit.
Yeah.
And so they gain reputation by additional evidence in good working journals. So this is dumbfounded. And the other issue is even worse than we have that. If I may enlarge on that.
Yeah, let tell us about that.
You'll find an account of that in one of the skeptical inquirers. I think it was the first one this year, just for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain professor in Vienna, in the Medical University of Vienna, Michael Fraß. He's one of my bitter adversaries.
Okay, one of your arch enemies, yes.
we know each other, we kind of respect each other, but we fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
So he published a paper on homeopathy on cancer treatment on non-small cell lung cancer, NSCLC, and he found that his homeopathic additional treatment prolonged the lifetime of the patients quite considerably, and they had a much better quality of life than anybody else, than in the control group. And we found that this result is absolutely come by cheating.
Ah.
Fraß definitely cheated. He really manipulated his data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you, there is, the study was registered with a US government register, And there the history of changes is kept. And if you look, if you compare what the first registration, the data on the first registration with what he put out in his study, it's a vast difference. Mm. In the first registration, it was three kind of cancers he wants to look at. In the final paper, it's only one. In the first draft, it was only one exclusion criterion, being pregnant.
Yeah.
In the final paper, there have been 20.
So they go through all of this, and then they just pick the random things that support the idea, or he did.
Mm. Yes, and the protocol, the first protocol, this is dated well before when he first recruited his first participants, but it was uploaded only after the data were available to him.
So he backdated it.
And backdated it to 2015, but... In 2015, he mentioned a software to where he wanted to do the statistics by, which was not available in 2015, but later on. So,
oh, wow.
All of this you may find in the Skeptical Inquirer.
Yeah.
And we contacted Fras. I know him personally. So I said, Michael, you cheated. What's your comment? And his comment was it took him about 14 days to re-upload another protocol, but still predated much. But this protocol is meeting his final study to the line, to the dot.
Okay.
So
he responded by cheating once more.
He responded by cheating once more. So we contacted the Medical University of Vienna, the research dean there.
Mm-hmm.
Because Fras cited he was his affiliation, the Medical University of Vienna, and so they are involved and they should do something about. And they forwarded the matter to the Austrian Agency for Research Integrity or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they took a year to look into the study, and they came to the conclusion. Yes, this study was forged. The data were manipulated, and they had access to the original data that Fras apparently provided them. And together with the medical university, they contacted the journal, which is The Oncologist, a very respectable journal published now in Oxford University Press, mm-hmm. together with our letter to the editor. And four of the co-authors already had retracted their co-authorship.
Wow.
Okay, still, that's a good sign, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And still, this paper sits in the database and is not retracted.
Mm.
And when the Medical University of Vienna and the ÖAVI, this Austrian Agency for Scientific Integrity, when they contacted the journal, this was about early in 2022. They raised a letter of concern. Expression of concern is published together with the paper, but that's all. They started their own investigation into the matter, but this is going on and on and on and on and on. And here, the things are much, much clearer
mm-hmm.
than in the other case we talked about. You know, you see the cheat when you see it, predating a protocol
it's so obvious.
By a couple of years, two times. This doesn't happen by chance. You have to have some energy to do that.
Yeah.
And still...
It's not just bad luck. It's consistent.
Yeah.
it's consistent, yes. And we were four of us who did this analysis, and mm-hmm. Only two of us, we forwarded this letter to the editor. And now we resorted to once in a month, contact the editor and say, what are you doing? What are you waiting? And Victor, my colleague, he did a good job this time. He cited the Gärtner issue, what we talked about,
mm-hmm.
and said, look, pediatric research only took 1 year from publication mm-hmm. to retraction. Maybe you could contact the people over there and find out how they did it and learn something, learn something to improve the process.
Yeah, I think you're doing a great job, Norbert.
Thank you.
So, but because of that, we don't want to keep you much longer.
Okay.
You've done an amazing job, and I think people will be very interested to hear what you have to say. So thank you so much for being on the show and for talking about your work.
Keep fighting the good fight.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, and keep healthy.
Yeah, you too. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Cheers.
Bye.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I can only repeat myself that Information Network Homeopathy and everyone who is active there, they're doing such an amazing job. And
yeah, they are.
I know that Norbert was very humble, but they have all the reasons to be proud. It's amazing what they're doing.
Yes, we are proud of them if they are not proud themselves.
Yes, they should be proud too, because it's amazing what they're doing.
Yep.
Yeah, and that was yet another interview that I had to miss. It's always super fun to talk to Norbert. He's an amazing guy. Mm-hmm. I'm just sorry I had to miss this. But I'm glad that we could do this recording. So shall we crack on with the rest of the show?
Definitely.
Yep. As usual, the first thing to bring in is This Week in Skeptical History, also known as Twitch. I would like to mention a very interesting moment in history this week, in French history, actually. The 10th of November is when we celebrate, or we can mention, the 230th anniversary of an event that was called the Fête de la Raison.
Wow.
That was an actual nationwide event. And it was part of the movement that came about with the French Revolution. So one of the things that the French Revolution had in mind was getting rid of the Roman Catholic Church. The reason for that was because they thought that, well, very rightly so, that they were full of corruption and they had to get rid of it.
Yeah, I have no argument with that.
Yeah, of course. And the interesting thing was that there were a couple of people who went a little bit further than most of the revolutionaries expected it to get. And that was something that was called the culte de la raison, so the cult of reason. Among those people were people like Jacques Hébert, Antoine-François Montmorot, and Pierre-Gaspard Chaumette. These people were the main organizers of things like bringing down church altars and getting rid of crosses in churches and even in cemeteries. That is a very, very brave thing to do, that was, even with the support and the background of the French Revolution. Some of the first steps of this movement were pretty anthropocentric. So it was all about elevating people and, instead of a god, bringing the idea of using reason and liberty and the truth being always the main moving force. That is something that we could all relate to, right? So it would be pretty good to see all over the place. However, as with most of the things that happened around the French Revolution, it went a little bit too far. The society was not ready for that. It was a little bit too violent as well. So, for example, when Joseph Fouché, one of those revolutionaries, he ordered, as I said, all crosses and statues to be gotten rid of from all the graveyards. And he replaced it, all the crosses, on the cemetery gates with an inscription, "Death is but an eternal sleep." It's something that a lot of people found a little bit too far-fetched. They wanted to believe. So when they came about with the Fête de la Raison, or the Festival of Reason, on the 10th of November 1793, they organized a lot of actions into church buildings, where they, as I said earlier, they dismantled the altars, including the one in Notre Dame in Paris. They transformed these temples, these church buildings, into the temples of reason, as they called them. They elevated altars of liberty. They elevated altars of philosophy. They wrote inscriptions above church doors that said, "To philosophy." As part of this festival of reason, that was another thing, because they didn't want to portray gods and goddesses of the reason. So they didn't want to use statues or idolatry, but they decided to dress up women as goddesses of the truth and goddesses of reason. One of them was the wife of one of the chief organizers, Momoro, by the name Sophie. And she was reportedly dressed a little bit too provocatively. So that didn't go down too well. And on the Wikipedia article, I found a very interesting comment by a scholar by the name Thomas Carlyle, who said that Sophie made one of the best goddesses of the reason, though her teeth were a little defective. So you can imagine that some people back in the time didn't really take care of their teeth very well. So yeah, this didn't last too long, because soon after this, the opposition from inside the revolutionary forces, including Maximilien Robespierre's unliking, because he was a believer, he wanted the belief system to be kept. So he moved against them, and soon all of these organizers of the Festival of Reason found themselves under the guillotine.
Ah,
just like Robespierre did in the end. But he as a counterforce, he came up with something that was called the Cult of the Supreme Being. So it was not the God of the Christians. It was basically the same kind of God, but it was not called the Christian Church or any kind of church. It was a cult of the Supreme Being, and that was to replace this cult of reason, but it didn't really work in the long run. And we could say that A for effort to these organizers, but it wasn't the true cause that they wanted to work for, unfortunately. The methods and the way they tried to achieve their goals was unfortunately too similar to those of the revolutionaries, and as a result, it was bound to fail. An interesting example of how not to try to turn society into a reasonable one. All right, so I was wondering, based on that, if Pontus here have something to poke the Pope for this week?
Nope, for the Pope. There's no news really worth mentioning about Francis this week, so we'll save it for the next one.
Okay, then let's move on to the news.
Yes, it's really interesting that this article popped up today in our collection of articles, because that was actually something that I wondered a few days ago, and I was like, that's funny.
A coincidence?
And I think not. And that is, have archaeologists discovered Noah's Ark?
Have they?
Did they? Yeah. I wondered about that because I was just wondering what the mountain was called that Noah landed on. In the Bible, it's called Ararat. I don't know if I pronounced it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's in Turkey, in today's Turkey. So there is a geological formation. It looks like a bit of rocks, but it also looks like maybe there was an ark there that basically sat on the landscape. People really believe that, and they really want to prove it. And now there's new proof out, or is it? As we all know, or maybe we don't, depending on how we grew up, according to Genesis, the book, not the band, when the flood waters were supposed to drown every evil soul on earth, Noah built an ark for his family, himself, and pairs of animals, excluding the unicorns. That's why we don't know them anymore.
And the dinosaurs.
And the dinosaurs.
Because they were deemed too evil.
Yes, the dinosaurs and the unicorns, both. Yeah, but the ark was supposed to be 134 meters by 22 by 13 meters. That's not big if you think about it, but it's still big for that time and to be supposed to be out of wood. But of course, we think, well, something so big with these dimensions for that time, that has to have left evidence. And this is where the formation that's called Durupinar comes in. It's located in Turkey and has been regarded as a potential resting place of this biblical boat. Because it does look like, if you look at it, it does look a bit like the bow of a boat. Yes. Mm-hmm. But I know several rocks that look like sleeping women or like a hand or whatever. And over the decades since it was identified or discovered in 1956, people have tried to prove it again. They say, well, we know that Noah and the Ark, that all happened 5,000 years ago. The vice rector of a university in Turkey, that which name I won't even try to pronounce. he said, we know that that happened 5,000 years ago, and there are signs that people have been active in that area between 5,000 and 3,000 BCE. That's for him as a proof. I would say for me, that's just a sign that there were people in that area, not necessarily that it was Noah and his descendants. The problem to find Noah's Ark is basically like finding Atlantis, because it's finding something that I would boldly say doesn't exist. It's hard to prove that. It's hard to prove a negative. We all know that. And finding this rock formation for me is like, is pareidolia, isn't it?
Yes, yes. You see something that isn't
you
there.
It sounds like that.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You see, seeing like a pattern in something that's actually just coincidence, or is it?
Yeah. Like you see an elephant in the clouds, or yeah. You see, yeah, things
or
like that.
Or a smile in an electrical plug or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was the Glasgow skeptics that commented on this today as mm-hmm. we record this, and they answered the question was, did archaeologists find Noah's Ark? And the answer was, no, they didn't. And they were not archaeologists. So this is driven by religious fanatics.
Usually science should be driven by itself, but we know that that doesn't work because science doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Yeah. It's unlike conversion therapy, right?
Hey,
it works.
Funny you should say that. Conversion therapy does not work. In fact, it is dangerous. It's a stupid idea. Mm-hmm. We talked about it before, but now it's in the news again, specifically in the UK. Conversion therapy, just to bring people up to date, is, of course, the pseudoscientific idea. It's a futile attempt to change or quote-unquote cure someone's sexual orientation or gender identity or such to make them more conform with heterosexual cisgender norms. So it's outright abuse and torture and mm-hmm. dangerous to the subject and the subject's health. It has never been shown to even work or to result in any kind of benefit for anyone. It's also, of course, totally unnecessary. Let people be who they are. Let them love whomever they want to, as long as everything is consensual, nobody gets hurt. You should let people be who they are. So there's all risk to this so-called therapy and no benefits at all.
Mm-hmm.
And very often it's driven by religious ideas as well. So because of all of this, conversion therapy is against the law in many countries, but not everywhere. If you take a look at Europe, it is banned in Iceland, Germany, Belgium, France, Spain, Greece, and Malta. Medical practitioners are forbidden to perform it in Switzerland, Portugal, and Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good, mm-hmm. but any other quack can apparently do it. Very strange to ban it just for medical practitioners. A ban has been considered in several other countries, Norway, Finland, the Netherlands, Austria, Ireland, and the UK. And the news this week is about the UK specifically. Banning conversion therapy was first promised by Prime Minister Theresa May in 2018, and then it has been repeated by every Prime Minister since then, including Rishi Sunak. It was pledged in the Queen's speech both in 2021 and 2022. In October this year, Sunak repeated the intention to include it in the King's speech. Now it's the King's speech, of course. That happened this week. The monarch actually doesn't decide what should be said. It's, of course, it's funny. You see Charles Chuck III sitting there saying, my government will do this, my government. Well, it's your government, but they are telling you what to say. You're just reading their letter. A bit silly.
Well, at least he has an opposition as well. So it's his Majesty's royal opposition.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that when Charles held the King's speech on Tuesday this week, there was no mention about banning conversion therapy. And a lot of people rightly are very upset about this. And it should be very simple to do. I mean, just not just to mention it, but to ban it. It should be banned. So why take it out? Especially since Sunak said just a month ago that it would be in. So I don't trust King Charles. He is pro all kinds of alt-med things, mm-hmm. for one thing, including homeopathy, Gerson therapy, acupuncture, TCM, Ayurveda, detox, iridology, chiropractic, herbal medicine, and osteopathy. Oh,
that's a long list.
Yeah, there is the list goes on, but I will spare you. He's not exactly pro-science. And according to an investigation by Pink News that they did last year, he has actually never given his opinion on LGBTQ rights, ever. And he has, as Prince of Wales, got into all kinds of debates about also other things, but he's never approached that area at all. And he is also known to have been interfering in secret with politics in the UK in the past, despite absolutely not being allowed to do so. So, to me, it is not entirely impossible that he persuaded Sunak to cut the line out about conversion therapy. So I'm now launching my own little conspiracy theory here, and I don't see why I couldn't. Everybody else seems to be able to do that, so why cannot I? Yeah, I don't know. But the question is, why was it cut out when the Prime Minister said it should be in, and the intention has been for several years now to ban conversion therapy? And there's Charles not saying it. So a bit strange. Anyway, it doesn't matter if it's a conspiracy or not. This fact that it wasn't mentioned is now stirring up a lot of feelings in the UK, and rightly so. We just don't know what happened, but I hope it was just some sort of oversight and they will still go ahead with the plans anyway.
Yeah, conversion therapy is really a bad idea, and esoterics for fertility is also a bad idea, as I can tell you. There is a new podcast out by Katharina Nokun. She's a journalist and a former politician. She looked at the esoteric market and fertility, and it was really interesting. There are several things that I really got shocked by, Of course, this is difficult because they prey on vulnerable people. These are people that want to have a baby, that want to get pregnant and usually have tried for years. They're also falling victim a bit on the German health system because you have to wait a very long time to get into a fertility clinic. 3 to 6 months. That's like 2/3 of a pregnancy, if you think about it. And in that time, a lot of people then say, oh, maybe while we wait, we can try this ritual or we can try this candle. The problem is, and there are several problems that I will tell you about. For example, it's very, very expensive. Several thousands of euros just for a ritual that claims they clean the old DNA out of your womb and that your womb then is like totally clean and you can have a healthy baby, which is dangerous to promise.
Well, you shouldn't try to take DNA out of any body part at all. That's crazy.
Yeah.
What is old DNA? I mean,
I think it's the idea that older ovaries, and that is actually like, because ovaries are created in the body while the baby is still in the womb of the mother. So it's like when the pregnant person becomes pregnant, the ovaries are already as old as she is. And that is actually biology. That is like the...
Yeah, but that's the same for every...
Yes.
All
yes.
DNA
yes.
has been gone from generation to generation. I didn't invent my DNA from scratch.
No. But it's just that the risk of, for example, genetic disorders, that it does go up if you're beyond a certain age.
That's true,
what they claim they do, that they cleanse the old DNA out, which is like, of course, completely rubbish. They don't have like... ovary x-rays there. And there are also witch rituals that Guido Bockamp of the Customer Protection Association talked about. He said there are rituals that cost up to 20,000 euro. There are also some that cost 70,000, depending on how many witches you want to have at the rituals. The usual thing is having an esoteric candle for 30 or some oil for 20 euro. But of course, these people are at risk to get preyed upon for more expensive, more dangerous rituals, more dangerous and more expensive things. And as I said, they are targeting vulnerable people because they're creating hope and at the same time can't provide any evidence or nor any hope. And what they also tell the people that want to get pregnant is that you have to follow all the rules. You have to follow everything we say, because if you don't, and if you won't get pregnant, then it's your own fault.
Blaming the victim. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Blaming the victim. Exactly. And at the same time, they're also saying, if you're having an IV child, then you're creating a person with a soul without empathy. This is like fucked up on so many levels. It's just like, don't go to IV, go to this witch ritual. But you also, it's also your fault if you don't get pregnant. So as I said, it's a lot of money, but they're also losing out on time for their medical fertility process if they only do esoterics, which are non-effective, as we know. Yeah. There have been attempts to from people to get their money back because they have been scammed. And there, the police or lawyers even ridiculed the victims and blame them. It's really hard. And as we can basically boil this down to, is that it really can also not only the wallet, but it can also hurt psychologically. Because if you blame yourself and if you hear your body is not ready for a child because your soul isn't, and it's your emotional blockage, that's lots of pressure. And then they say you should manifest your pregnancy with your thought. You can never really digest that you can't get pregnant because you're manifesting it. And it can really, really wreck your mental health. And at the same time, these rituals and these shamans, they don't only offer that for fertility. They also offer it for getting pregnant if you have uterus cancer.
Oh.
And yeah, I'm really like emotional about it because I get so, so angry about it. It's not okay. But I'm happy that this podcast is out. I can only recommend listening to it. It's in German, but I did give a bit of a rundown here. So yeah, it's a hot topic and I'll stay on that topic because it's important.
Yeah. Do you remember we talked about, I can't remember what episode it is now, but we mentioned Charles before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He also got into that. He advocated, or he had a house, I can't remember, a manor of sorts up in, maybe it was in Scotland, where people could go and they could do all kinds of nice things, I guess, relax. But they also offered reflexology for fertility, which is when you massage your feet, and which is not the right part of the body to massage if you want to get it on.
But,
well some people like
it. Well-done foot massage could easily lead into making babies. So
okay, okay. Well, before we hear more confessions from Andras, maybe.
Not speaking from own experience, but I've heard.
Yeah, I've read
like
a lot of books.
So
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, there are lots of falsehoods, misinformation, even disinformation that is deliberately spread. The UN and UNESCO decided to team up with Ipsos and order a representative survey conducted in 16 countries. The countries were chosen based on whether there is an election coming up in 2024. Some of the countries included in the survey were European countries, Belgium, Austria, Romania, Croatia, and Ukraine. The goal was to find out what the attitudes and beliefs are about disinformation and what the most prominent sources of disinformation people think are. As I said, it was a representative survey with 8,000 individuals altogether, so about 500 per country. And the collection happened between the 22nd of August and the 25th of September. Some of the findings are not very surprising, but others are a little bit so. First of all, what surprised me the most was in the countries surveyed, 56% of internet users said that they frequently use social media to stay informed about current events. And it's a far higher number than people using television for that purpose. The interesting part is that most of the developed countries they use social media for that purpose only in 37% of the cases. And they are mostly reliant on television to gather information on current events. It shows that the lower the country's human development index is, the higher the proportion of using social media for gathering information is. It's really surprising. I don't know if it surprises you as well, but it did me.
Yeah, I think it's different. I mean, I'm sure it's different in different age groups as well.
Yes, yes. In this survey, they didn't really control for that. They tried to assess a lot of things, but the control for age groups did not happen. It was just a homogeneous sample between age of 18 and 65. But there are other things, like the questions that try to assess how aware they are about disinformation being present on social media and on TV. And it looks like people trust social media less than TV. Across all the 16 countries, it's a 68% that told the surveyors that social media is a place where disinformation is most widespread. However, the amount of threat and the level of threat that disinformation means is also interesting. In countries with lower levels of human development index, 85% are concerned about the impact and the influence that disinformation can have on their lives, with special regards to the elections. About 87% believe that political influence of disinformation has already happened in their countries. And then they go on to find out how the disinformation problem should be addressed. Not just disinformation, but hate speech as well was asked about in the survey. There is a large agreement across the board about governments and regulatory bodies being important to be involved, including social media platforms themselves. 90% of the respondents agreed on that. But when it comes to the citizens themselves being responsible and to what extent they should be involved in tackling disinformation online, it's a mere 48% who agreed with that. When they went on to asking people about whether they have already reported disinformation, it goes way down to 17% of people who are often doing that. So we all agree, I think, that disinformation should be tackled on all fronts, but we need to do our own share of the work as well. Interestingly, the United Nations announced a plan. They even trying to bring together regulators and the platforms themselves in the near future, as they say. But they are coming up with a plan as well, a written plan collected from different actors. Like 10,000 contributions have been filed so far from 134 countries in the last 18 months. They are working out principles for all the countries how to tackle disinformation. So, yes, it's good to see that there is an awareness about the problem internationally. But unfortunately, I'm a little bit skeptical as to how interested the local governments might be in tackling disinformation when it's beneficial to them from a political point of view. I have my doubts. This survey just shows that even most of the people agree that there is something to worry about when it comes to disinformation. So let's see what we all can do about that. And, well, our part... part is to hand out awards, really right awards, really wrong awards. So let's see what we are handing out this week.
Yes, and I have to, of course, bring the mood down a bit by ranting. This week's prize will be a really wrong, as you might have guessed from that. As people that watch the BBC know, there is a show called Just One Thing. It is presented by a doctor, Michael Mosley, and they present just one thing that will make your life more healthy. If you think about this principle, it sounds really cool, right? Like, if I would hear that, I would be like, okay, that's certainly a really right award. If they say, oh yeah, maybe one thing, take a walk, or one thing a day, eat some veggies, whatever. That's cool. That's educating the public and giving health tips and little disclaimer here, don't take health advice from this podcast, even if I tell you to eat your veggies. But yeah, so it sounds good. The idea sounds good. The problem here was that in a most recent show, an episode called Embrace the Rain, he certainly went over into a misleading field. He said, you should take walks in the rain, you should embrace the rain. It's very healthy for you because the air is full of negative ions and these ions are effective against depression. That's what got said in this show and also during an interview with Professor Michael Terman, who also explained his research on this topic. Terman insisted that this was more than a placebo effect. It would help against depression. And yeah, that's very interesting. And there is a review out that states that there has been considerable interest in the potential effect of negative air ions on human health and well-being. The problem is that these conclusions have been inconsistent and the mechanisms remain unclear because people did what Norbert Aust also did and they looked at the study and they said, well, it's not really consistent here. Also, just a tiny cherry on top is that this professor who insists that this is working, guess what he's selling?
Rain.
Almost.
Umbrellas.
Almost.
Umbrellas.
No, he's holding a patent for a negative ion generator. Ooh. Here you go. So, as I said, it's cool that the BBC and Michael Mosley do this healthcare show, and the idea is really cool. But for embracing the rain, that will rain on our parades, and for not taking their own responsibility seriously, the BBC and Michael Mosley receive this week's prize for being really wrong.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hope it rains on his wedding if he's getting married.
Yes. That wouldn't be ironic, don't you think?
Yeah, as we like to say, it's well deserved. Yes. So that basically concludes our show. But as usual, we need a quote before we can really finish this episode.
Yes, and everyone who knows me knows that I like the short and sweet quotes. This quote is by beloved Hans Rösling, or did I pronounce that right, Pontus?
Rösling.
Hans Rösling. And he was a Swedish physician, academic and public speaker. And I sadly say was because he is still very missed. He was a professor of international health at Karolinska Institute and wrote a wonderful book called Factfulness that was published posthumously. We talked about him before and this is the quote. We need to let data drive our decisions, not our prejudices. End quote.
Yes. That is easily more easily said than done, but he is quite right.
And this is exactly what we said before, that science doesn't exist in a vacuum. And sometimes it does happen that prejudices and our preconceived notions drive the research. But as Rösling said, we need to let data drive our decisions and not that. Mm. So that's why I wanted to present that to you.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank both of you for today, Annika and Pontus.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Also, many thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Please keep doing so. And until next week, goodbye.
Tschüss.
Hejdå.
Bis lad.
This has been your ESP experience. The show is produced and recorded by the ESP.eu. Join us again next time, but until then, please send your feedback, comments, or death threats to info@theesp.eu. We would also love to hear your ideas and suggestions regarding future episodes, as well as news from your country of residence that might interest others across the continent. If you have a local event or organization to promote, please don't hesitate to let us know, as we are more than happy to help. All music in the program was written and performed by Keisha J. Gray and George Schwab and is used with their permission. Please check out our webpage at www.theesp.eu, follow us on Twitter at @espodcast_eu, and like us on Facebook. I don't know how you can believe.
In the treatment of ADHD.
HD&D. You cut that out and I do it once again.
Yes, so what's next?
The update from Olaf.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. You're waiting for me. I'm sorry. Then I messed up. Oh, Jesus.
They use social media for that purpose only 50... Fuck me.